Dr. Mary's Monkey, How the Unsolved Murder of a Doctor, A Secret Laboratory in New Orleans, and Cancer-Causing Monkey Viruses Are Linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK Assassination, and Emerging Global Epidemics. Edward Haslam is the author. It's a fascinating story. There's a lot of moving parts to this, but it really does come together. We'll talk about that coming up in just a moment. We'll trace the story of how this starts with Edward Haslam's father to where it ends in an almost groundbreaking expose on 60 Minutes that never happens. And we'll tell you all about why and what happens in the middle next with Edward Haslam on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Edward Haslam, it's going to be a pleasure not just to talk with you about your fascinating research, but also to use you as a cheap excuse to play my favorite New Orleans music all night long, as bumpers.
Thank you.
I'm sure you'll recognize many of these songs.
Oh, yeah, playing. It makes me feel right at home.
It should. Now, are you native of New Orleans?
I lived in New Orleans for 35 years. I wasn't born there, but just shortly afterwards, my family lived there, and I worked in New Orleans music for a number of years, so I know people like the Meters and Professor Longhair and
yeah, how about all that
stuff personally.
A little Dr. John action sound good to you, too,
yes,
maybe?
Of course.
And then later you were in advertising, wasn't it?
That's right. I started my advertising career in New Orleans and working with accounts like Tabasco, Pepper Sauce, and
sure.
I was pulled up to Detroit, and I worked with the Chrysler Corporation and with Rockwell International for a number of years, and then moved down here to Florida around 2000 to continue my advertising career, and that's more or less what I still do now.
Yeah, along the way, though, this investigation into something which originally comes into your life via your father, and I want you to tell that story. But it's not like you've published this story before in fits and starts. I think you have brought together here something which I really enjoyed reading. You're a very good writer. Obviously, you're a professional writer in an advertising context, but this is different. I think you really are making a pretty strong case for what many might consider to be a bizarre story. It just seems like it encompasses almost too much to be true.
Well, one thing, I look at it as a very sane, very clear-headed investigation into a very crazy subject.
Yeah, good way of looking at it.
Yeah.
I can see that.
And the other thing is the story pretty much came to me. I didn't go to it.
Let's talk about how it came to you when you were a kid in this first glimpse you had of something going on with your dad.
Well, my father was a professor of orthopedic surgery at Tulane Medical School. And that gave me insights into things that I wouldn't ordinarily have seen. I became aware of the monkey virus research going on in New Orleans at a very early age. I even remember when I was waiting to take my polio vaccine sugar cube, the kid next to me, he pocketed his sugar cube and said he wasn't going to take it because it was full of monkey viruses. I mean, I became aware of this monkey virus issue connected to the polio vaccine in particular very early along. And then what happened later was one of the people that my father taught with, I mean, this woman was a nationally respected, if not internationally respected doctor, who held very high offices in the world of medicine, and she was murdered in 1964. And I got inside information about that, things that were not told to the public, that made me extremely suspicious of it. And the other thing that happened in the background, I was in high school in the 1960s, and in New Orleans in the 1960s, that's when Jim Garrison was investigating the Kennedy assassination. And I had classmates and teachers and friends who had family members involved in that investigation, on both sides of it, actually. So I got a pretty good front row seat of what was going on, and I got to hear things that were not being discussed in the media. And the media was aggressively anti-Garrison throughout the whole thing. And my concerns of what I heard, because I heard about this underground medical laboratory that Garrison had talked about in this 1967 interview in Playboy magazine. My concern was so specific to that because the assumption was they were working on a biological weapon, that in 1969, I actually said to my classmates, you know, hey, the good news is if we have this bizarre global epidemic involving cancer and a monkey virus 30 years from now, hey, at least we'll know where it came from. And I knew we would never be able to explain this story because it is like Clockwork Orange. I mean, it's a complex story. And unless somebody was able to come out with kind of an iconoclastic movie like Oliver Stone finally did, on the JFK thing that explained who people like David Ferry were and what was going on in New Orleans. And, you know, Oliver would probably shoot me for this, but his movie is a great warm-up act for reading my book.
Because, I would say so.
Because it gives you a feel for who the players are and what the context is in the background.
Well, let's just go ahead and you mentioned her, so let's talk a little bit about the death of Dr. Mary Sherman. And why was this such a famous murder in New Orleans?
Well, first of all, it was a very sensational murder that was an above-the-fold news story on both newspapers for over 2 weeks. And then suddenly, they just stood up and said, we're not going to be able to solve this thing, and they shut it down. And when you do that, you create a lot of suspicion and rumors about what was going on. First of all, let me tell you who Mary Sherman was.
Yeah,
Mary
explain what how she died and all that too.
Okay. When Jim Garrison did this Playboy interview, he said that he had associated David Ferry, who was his prime suspect in the JFK case, with Dr. Mary Sherman, who had been murdered, and that they were doing some sort of secret cancer experiments, okay? And most of the JFK kind of researchers who were aware of this didn't think much of that passage because they didn't have a clue as to who Mary Sherman was. Mary Sherman came out of the University of Chicago, and that's one of the great intellectual power stations in the United States. I mean, it rivals Harvard or Stanford or anything else. And at the University of Chicago, during the time that Mary Sherman was there, is when Enrico Fermi was there developing nuclear energy. The first sustained nuclear reaction was at the University of Chicago. And she was coming out of this highly prestigious organization, University of Chicago. And when she got into medicine, she rose rapidly to the top rank. She was the chairman of the pathology committee of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. And right before she moved to New Orleans in 1952, she was working at Billings Hospital, which is one of the places implicated in the plutonium experiments. And she had so many articles published, and they were quoted for so long that even though she died in 1964, I found references to her articles into the 1990s. I mean, there are dozens of references. And she was a real major hitter in medicine. And today at the Ochsner Clinic, where she worked in New Orleans, there is the Mary Sherman Bone Pathology Laboratory. Okay, now what the public was told, and really the key contribution I think I make towards all this, is I figured out what actually happened to Mary Sherman versus what the public was told. But I'm going to start with what the public was told. They found her body naked in her bedroom. It had been stabbed 7 or 8 times and set on fire. Now, that's a fairly sensational set of circumstances. This was an apartment complex, had about 13 or 14 apartments in it, and it was a wood-frame building, and it was so acoustically transparent that the neighbors said they could normally hear Dr. Sherman walking around in her slippers upstairs. Yet nobody in the building heard a thing that night, which adds to the mystery of the whole thing.
Sure.
What happened was 30 years later, I was able to get my hands on the police reports and the autopsy reports. And what I discovered was that Mary Sherman's arm was missing, just like my mother had told me decades before. But it was not only missing, It had been disintegrated by heat, and so had the entire right side of her rib cage, so that when you looked at the body, you could see the internal organs, like the lungs and the liver and stuff. Okay. Now, that type of burn, and immediately next to that, I will add right now, was unburned human hair. And so I started focusing on the issue of how much temperature does it take to burn a bone, and whatever that number is, how do you get that temperature precisely focused next to human hair? Because right. we've all burned hair on our forearms around a stove or something, because it's the easiest thing to burn on the body.
And especially have it burn in such a way that it almost, it just burns off one part of the body, but at a temperature that hot, it didn't melt the ceiling, the lamps, everything that's around it.
The curtains, and they even piled bedclothes on her to use as fuel for the fire, and the fuel for the fire didn't even fully burn. And so I started looking into this, and I interviewed somebody who cremated people for a living, because I was trying to find out what the numbers were. And he said, oh, a couple of hours, 2 hours at 1600 degrees, but when you're finished, you still have bones. And we grind up the bones into dust, and that's what people get back after
sure.
a cremation.
Right.
But the point is, if 2 hours at 1600 degrees won't do it, and she had clothing piled on top of her that would burn at 500 degrees and it didn't burn, then there's something fundamentally wrong with the crime scene. And then I realized there was nothing in her apartment that could have caused the damage to her body, which is why they never told the public about it, because they were in a situation that they could not defend, because Mary Sherman obviously had a problem that burned off her arm and rib cage somewhere else in town that night, and they didn't want to get people sniffing around trying to figure out where it was.
So here you have this prominent doctor, well-liked, very well-respected woman who living a scandalous life or anything. I mean, she's an established member of the medical community, but somewhere that night she's murdered, and part of her body is burned off, and then the body is transferred back to her apartment.
Right. And a detail on that that's very interesting is that of the 7 stab wounds on her, the actual cause of death was a very precise slit-like wound directly to the center of the heart, as if somebody with pretty good medical knowledge had done it. The other wounds were all kind of helter-skelter, and the slit-like wound to the heart hemorrhaged or bled, and you bleed when you're alive, and you don't bleed when you're dead, and all of the other wounds did not bleed. Now, what that means is that there were 2 fires and 2 sets of stab wounds. So the sequence of events is she gets electrocuted. It burns off her right arm and rib cage. She is near death, but not dead, because the electricity did not cross her heart. Then somebody who is with her cuts off her clothes, because you do that in third-degree burns, maybe even gives her some morphine at that point in time, because that's what you do with third-degree burns. And then they decide that she's not going to recover, and they've got to get her back to her apartment. And whoever it is does a mercy killing by stabbing her in the heart. So the person that actually kills her is not necessarily the person that blew off her arm. And then they bring her body in a body bag back to her apartment. They quietly come in the apartment. They turn off the burglar alarm because they have her keys. They unlock the door. They come in. They drop her on the bed, take her out of the body bag. At that point in time, she's upside down in the bed, but they don't care. They rapidly grab a bunch of folded underwear from the drawer, nightgowns and stuff, throw it on top of her, and at that moment, they stab her with the helter-skelter type stab wounds, because there are V cuts in the underwear. So we know that's when those cuts were done. And she's already dead at that point, so she doesn't feel anything. And then they set her on fire in order to try to create an explanation, however tenuous, for the burns that she suffered earlier. And the key point of control, the reason we know this is a cover-up at this point in time, is that the fact that her arm was missing was never mentioned in any of the very many press articles that covered it. And it's impossible for me to believe that with all the cops there and the people handling the body and the people doing the autopsy and everything else, that was not widely known amongst the insiders. Yeah.
Well, see, and again, this is we're talking about Dr. Mary's Monkey. It's a book by Edward Haslam, and it's a true story. And that's part of the Dr. Mary Sherman part. We'll get back to that a little bit later on. But let's then kind of go back to where you were starting off with this. And that is this underground laboratory that was going on in New Orleans. David Ferries, the character that was played by Joe Pesci in the movie JFK, and David Ferry is kind of a nefarious character. He was in the movie JFK. They talked about him trying to cure cancer in a homemade laboratory, something that was going on in his apartment. Is that true?
Yes. And the point about Ferry is Ferry was a very well-educated, very smart man who was involved in a lot of dangerous and illegal stuff. He was a pilot for the CIA flying missions into Cuba. He was connected to Carlos Marcello, who's the mafia boss in New Orleans. He was arrested for pedophilia for his relationships with underage boys, so he was a sex offender. He has a constellation of problems around him. And his relationship with Mary Sherman creates the nexus of the combination of a world-class medical researcher with a radical political entity. And that combination of resources is what is so dangerous and has always concerned me more than who shot Jack Kennedy, because it involved the possibility of a biological weapon. And yeah. I thought tracking down the biological weapon was much more important than anything. And the reason I started off trying to find out what happened to Mary Sherman because I was concerned about this biological weapon. But what I offer as an insight into this is this one murder of Mary Sherman is like Walt Whitman's blade of grass. That if you understand this blade of grass, you'll understand the universe. If you understand really what happened to Mary Sherman, it springs out into so many other subjects, from the polio vaccine to linear particle accelerators to plots to kill Castro to involvements with the accused assassin of the president of the United States. I mean, all that stuff is orbiting around this one murder. Sure. And these are the subjects that we're going to get into in a couple of minutes.
And we'll say again, there are a lot of moving parts to this story, but you bring it together very well in your book. So congratulations on that.
Thanks.
But back to David Ferry for a second. He is brilliant, but he's also got this really dark and very troubled side. And so what's he doing trying to cure cancer in his apartment? I mean, in 30, 40 seconds of that, give us a little bit more about David Ferry's cancer lab in his apartment.
Well, first of all, David Ferry thought he was a doctor and thought that he was on the road to curing cancer. And he had been doing cancer experiments by himself for many years. And people who knew him prior to this project on Louisiana Avenue have told me that. On Louisiana Avenue, what they were doing is this was a sponsored operation. It involved very sophisticated people and very sophisticated equipment, and they were trying to develop a biological weapon to kill Fidel Castro that had plausible deniability in it. The United States had promised hands off on Cuba, and the people of New Orleans were very angry about the fact that Castro had pointed nuclear-tipped Russian missiles at New Orleans, and the trade had been cut off with Cuba, and that hurt New Orleans economically, and right. The potential of Castro spreading the revolution to the rest of Latin America would have been catastrophic for New Orleans financially, because that was 75% of their trade, and
okay,
there was a lot of anger.
And that's where we'll pick it up then. Dr. Mary's Monkey, next continues with Edward Haslam on Coast to Coast AM on a Sunday night. This is Ian Punnett. Something really cool about New Orleans pop music and New Orleans jazz and New Orleans blues and pretty much anything New Orleans. New Orleans funk. I mean, everything about New Orleans, it has a unique flavor to it. There are some cities in the United States where you could almost kind of close your eyes and walk a couple of blocks and open your eyes, and you could have been transported from one city to another city and not even have known it. But there's no mistake in New Orleans somehow. When you're there, you'll know what I mean. If you've never spent any time there, you ought to go. You ought to see it as it's still bouncing back from Katrina. But that's one of the reasons why the backdrop for this story is so fascinating, because in a way, kind of almost anything goes in New Orleans. And there's a kind of a unique worldview of the residents of New Orleans. It kind of opens up for some possibilities of things you might not try in other cities. That's some of the explanation for the weird events of Dr. Mary's Monkey. It's the true story that Edward Haslam is reporting to us tonight. And we're just getting started. We're kind of a little bit into the chapters of this book, but hang with this story because it comes together beautifully as the investigation continues next. How does this end up involving the JFK conspiracy? And for that matter, the next emerging global epidemic. How did this all get started so many years ago? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Dr. Mary's Monkey is the somewhat a bit of a memoir in a way, at least at the beginning. In fact, Edward, if you go with me a little bit on this, we'll get back to where we left off. But I'd love to have you tell the story about what you overheard your father talking about, the fear that your father had in the early 60s about some of the things he was learning about that were going on in New Orleans. Can you talk about that?
Well, it starts with my grandfather, who was a doctor also, and my grandfather helped develop the first anthrax vaccine. And my grandfather had a very clear idea that you are either a doctor or a soldier, but you're not both. You don't use medicine as a weapon. And the temptation to use medicine as a weapon was very clear from the days of anthrax. And my father had a brilliant Navy career. He was a Harvard doctor. He joined the Navy by the time he was 29. He was a commander. They told him that they were going to make him an admiral, and he had to do certain things. And one day he came home and said, I left the Navy, and went on with his life. And the decision to leave the Navy has always been something that was a question in my mind and part of our family history. And one day, about 1964, it was that summer, and I remember that because we literally moved across the street into another house, and we did that right in 1964, and we had just gotten in this new house. I overheard my father, who's a very deep-keeled man who hardly ever complained about anything, just absolutely bitterly complaining about the fact that something was going on down at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. And he said, we fought wars to stop people from doing stuff like this. And he was referring, in my interpretation of that, to the Nazi medical experiments and the Japanese medical experiments, because there were some edges to humanity and civilization which were being violated by those people. And when he found out that we were doing similar types of things on federal government property at the U.S. Public Health Service, which was a facility intended to protect the American people from diseases, he was just outraged at it. And my mother cautioned him, said, you know, honey, I don't think there's much you can do about it at this point. And he said, it's just that I gave up so much to keep stuff like this from happening. And now to find out that it's going on in my own backyard just makes me sick.
And you even tried to get him to tell you more about that before he died, the night before his surgery. Talk a little bit about your dad's reaction to your growing curiosity.
Well, my father was a chronic smoker, and he developed lung cancer. And because he and I talked a lot, I knew that if you go in for major surgery like that, at least in the technology of the day, you didn't have a real good chance of coming out of it, and particularly if you were a chronic smoker. And so we both assumed that when he was going in, he probably wasn't coming out. And therefore, we had a last chance conversation where he gave me instructions about taking care of my mother and stuff like that. Right. And I figured this was going to be the last time I was going to be able to ask him about all this stuff that I knew he knew about and he wouldn't tell me about. So I asked him directly to talk to me about Mary Sherman. And he said he couldn't do it because he had to protect the family. And then I, you know, I was a cocky teenager. I said, well, what if I figured it out on myself? And he said, Ed, listen to me, because I'm not going to be able to say this to you again. If you figure this out and you decide to tell the world what you found, I need you to realize that you are going to be crossing swords with the most powerful people in our country. And I would suggest that you think twice before you cross them.
It's such an ominous warning that thankfully you didn't heed, as we now know a lot more about both the death of this famous New Orleans doctor, Dr. Mary Sherman, and then some of the things that that those connect to. So there was then the sort of a culture of people doing lab work in New Orleans. There was this sort of a little bit, I don't know if it's Wild West, but it certainly felt like that when I was reading your book, a little bit more sort of a frontier, if you can get away with it, go ahead kind of attitude about medicine.
Well, it's kind of the flip side of that. One is there was a lot of stuff going on nationally, and there were monkey labs all over the place, and I want to get into the monkey issue here in a minute. But sure. New Orleans was sort of out of the mainstream. Communications and jet travel and everything else were not nearly what they are today. New Orleans is the most European of all American cities. It's based on international trade. It's what happens when you put a French opera house in the middle of a French provincial slave colony. I mean, it's a very different kind of place. And they wound up with a problem of almost biblical proportions with the polio vaccine, which I'll talk about in a second. And they had research, and they, I'm talking about National Institute of Health, National Cancer Institute, the people up in Washington, that would have normally been done in places like Bethesda or at Fort Detrick. And they didn't want any of those sort of knowledgeable experts who are in the mainstream of their research knowing about this. So they hid this operation in New Orleans. And New Orleans, as you pointed out before, is a very tolerant place. It's very laissez-faire. There's this undercurrent that, oh, it's only New Orleans. Nothing important ever happens here because you never see it on the news, blah, blah, blah. And it was a great place to set up a secret laboratory, particularly when that secret laboratory involved building a linear particle accelerator, which I promise you nobody in New Orleans knew what it was, or hardly anybody. But they put it in the infectious disease laboratory on the grounds of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. Nobody goes into a building called the Infectious Disease Laboratory unless they got business there. And the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital was guarded by the U.S. Marine Corps. I'm talking about guys with guns at the gate.
Sure. Okay?
So there's no casual traffic there. And the campus of this place is about 12 buildings, 10 or 12 buildings. There's one big hospital, and then there's a bunch of outbuildings on the campus. And this building I'm referring to was at the back of the campus. It's one of the outbuildings. Again, there's no casual traffic at all. It's a perfect place to set up an underground medical laboratory. Now, why would they want to do that? Just about everybody listening to the show right now has had the polio vaccine. And if you're a baby boomer and you had the polio vaccine between 1955, when it was released, and 1962, the polio vaccine that you got was contaminated with monkey viruses. And I want to explain why. In order to make the polio vaccine, they had to grow the polio virus, and they discovered that the polio virus grew very nicely on the kidney cells of an Asian monkey called the rhesus monkey. And so what they would do is they would kill these monkeys, cut out their kidneys, grind them up, put them into dishes, and take the polio virus and put it in there, grow the polio virus, and then they would use that virus to make the vaccine. Now, when they took the polio virus out, they also got every other virus that was in the monkey's kidney. Okay, this was part of the production. This was true of both the Salk vaccine and the Sabin vaccine, and I'll talk about the difference between the two in a little bit. But it was after they released 100 million doses of the polio vaccine that the researchers up at the National Cancer Institute and the National Institute of Health, and I'm talking about Sarah Stewart and Bernice Eddy here, they discovered that there was a cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine. Now, when you realize you have just mass inoculated the entire population of the United States and their children with a cancer-causing virus, you realize you don't want to tell anybody what you did, because you have just committed the greatest mistake in the history of government. And secondly, you want to get real busy trying to find a solution before they found out what you did, so they don't take you out and lynch you. It would be nice to prevent. I mean, what this translates out to, just to take all of the varnish off of it, they were looking at, we're going to have an epidemic of cancer from what we just did unless we develop a vaccine in time. So they were very busy trying, and they didn't want to tell anybody about it. And they decided, they were desperate, and they decided to use radical methods that they normally would not have used in order to do this, which is why they built this linear particle accelerator, because they wanted to use the radiation from the particle accelerator to mutate the monkey virus that they were concerned about, which was SV40, into a benign strain that they could use for a vaccine. And they didn't want to tell anybody why they were irradiating monkey viruses, because the answer was, because we just mass inoculated the entire population with a cancer-causing virus.
Yeah.
And when I looked at that, I mean, that was really the go-no-go point in my decision, because I didn't set out to write a book. I set out to answer some questions for myself about Mary Sherman because of this conversation I had with my father, okay? And when I realized the scope of this thing, and you know, I said, I got to get my hands on the real statistics here. You know, do we have an epidemic of cancer or not? So I went to the medical library and I got the National Cancer Institute statistics, and I looked at them and got out my computer and graphed them and everything else. And there is no doubt whatsoever that we are in the middle of a massive epidemic of cancer, which seems to be focused on four or five cancers, and they're all soft tissue cancers, which happened to be one of Mary Sherman's specialties. She was a bone doctor, but her last article was published in a book called Tumors of the Bone and Soft Tissue. I mean, it's right where she was focused professionally.
Sure.
And so, you know, I mean, do you know anybody with cancer? You know, cancer rate is about 300 times what our grandparents were.
And the implication there is that this cancer that was the first tip over of the domino starts with the inoculation for polio, which they're trying to undo. Now, is that what your dad is so mad about?
What happened, that part of it starts in about 1960-61, and I even found people who are bioweapons experts who are involved in experimental design and safety control actually being, I mean, these people that normally work at Fort Detrick are in New Orleans teaching introductory biology to nursing students down the street from the accelerator, you know, as cover jobs. That part of it is kind of noble and is kind of desperate and is on the edges of ethics, but it's all defensible at that point in time. What happens in 1961-62 is the Russians move nuclear missiles into Cuba, and we have the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that changes the whole personality of everything. We now, I mean, of all the paranoia in the Cold War, it was never higher than at the Cuban Missile Crisis. And nobody was ever personally hated more than Fidel Castro, at least not in New Orleans. And when the decision was made to try to take out Castro in a method that the United States could claim was an accidental method, or, you know, a natural cause like cancer, because we were all told, you know, cancer was, you know, you couldn't give it. They didn't want us to know there was a cancer-causing virus, because you can't have an epidemic caused by one unless you have one. And they can't say that today because of the HPV vaccine, which is against a cancer-causing virus. So they've run out of excuses on this virus thing at this point. But once they started deliberately trying to take the more aggressive viruses that they were finding and producing in their experiments in their vaccine search, because they were trying to get stuff that was weaker, but they were also getting stuff that was stronger, which is one of the reasons it was so dangerous, and decided to use that as a biological weapon for the purpose of killing Fidel Castro, that's when my father tilted. I mean, I think he knew that's what they were doing, and anybody who's a medical professional, I've discussed this with professors of public health and stuff, anybody knows that if you do something that aggressive and that dangerous, you cannot keep it in the box. It's going to spread through the population. And then you have a real problem on your hands.
Sure.
Now, SV40, which was the target, I'm going to say is like the size of a basketball. And SIV, which is the simian immunodeficiency virus, which frequently traveled with it, is about the size of a golf ball. Okay. And they were trying to mutate SV40, but when they exposed SV40 to radiation, they also exposed SIV to radiation. And the question that I have as it relates to emerging global epidemics, and that's, you know, code language for AIDS, everyone can sure. see that, is the fact that the thing that the scientific community, everybody in the scientific community, mainstream, says it's caused by a mutated monkey virus. They're careful about the term mutation, but if you read what they say, that's where they're going. But nobody explains the mutation. And the mutation, case one, goes back, and I'm talking Scientific American, NCI Tumor Lab, all these kind of people, the epidemiologists, trace case one back to about 1960. Okay, so right at this period of time is when these people were mutating these monkey viruses in New Orleans. And that creates what they call propinquity, right place, right time, right people, and stuff like that. And it raises the possibility that there may be a connection between these experiments in New Orleans and the origin of AIDS. And that is a new theory of it, but it's one that I present, and it's a possibility, and I think it's one that ought to be taken seriously. And as I have talked to virologists and stuff, frankly, the higher up they are on the knowledge tree, the more seriously they understand the accusation, because they know that if you start messing with the genetic structure of viruses with radiation, you are playing roulette with the biological history of the planet.
Well, I want to sort of unpack that a little bit too, coming up next hour. Just real quickly, how does this relate back to, you know what, I guess we won't be able to do this real quickly anyway, but here's where I want to start, is let's go back to David Ferry. Again, the character we're probably best known for is the presentation of David Ferry by Joe Pesci in the movie JFK. Bad homemade hair pieces, brilliant guy, but a pedophile, related to JFK in the investigation. We'll talk more about that. But doing this, having his home laboratory, trying to come up with an agent to get Fidel Castro. I want to tie in David Ferry to everything you just said. And then how does this relate to the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman? And honestly, we're not even halfway into the story. The true life account of Dr. Mary's monkey, the investigator on this is Edward Haslam. He lived it, and he is still exploring it, coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.